This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for this second hour of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be spending a little bit of time talking about African-American women, the role that they played in civil rights and in 20th century black history. And that is the subject of a symposium that's going on here on the U of I campus and will be for a couple of days. This is sponsored by the African American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. Today and tomorrow, we will have guests who are here visiting the campus to take part in this symposium. And our first guests, our guest here for this morning, is Darlene Clark Hine. She's professor of African American Studies and professor of history at Northwestern University. She's also director of the Center for African American History there. She is a leading historian of the African American experience and one of the people who helped found the field of black women's history. She's also been one of its leading scholars. She will be giving a talk, and that's tonight at 7 o'clock. This is the Ida B. Wells Barnett Lecture, and it will be taking place in the auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on Gregory Street in Urbana. And I expect that anyone who would be interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. She'll speak on the topic, From Respectability to Respect, Black Women's Civic Culture and Consciousness in Jim Crow America. Also, tomorrow morning, maybe I'll just mention here, tomorrow morning, we'll also talk with another speaker who is here to take part in the symposium, and that's Juliana Richardson. She is the founder and executive director of the History Makers Initiative based in Chicago, and she'll be talking about, with us and also as part of the symposium, she'll be talking about her organization's efforts to record and archive interviews with many both well-known and unsung African Americans. So she'll be here on this program tomorrow. We're very pleased to have Professor Hine here with us. And as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. I came across a quote that from you that I think might make a good place to start. And I believe that this was something that you said as part of a documentary that was made some years ago now that was taking a look at the experiences of minority faculty in higher education. Mm-hmm. And you said something along these lines, that historians can choose to write about anything they like, but first what they have to do is decide that that thing or that event or that person is worthy of their investigation. And you said, apparently, this is some time ago, but you said, apparently, no one had ever thought black women were worth studying. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that is why you chose to make that a major focus of your research and have been doing that now for some time. Let's go back to that moment when it is you said that, and perhaps when you would have been beginning your career as an academic. It was a certain point at which it struck you and you said, wait a minute, there's something very important here that has not gotten the attention that it should.
Well, actually, what happened was a group of black women who were members of and leaders of the Indianapolis section of the National Council of Negro Women. I was then at Purdue University, had called and asked me to write a history of black women in Indiana. And although I was an associate professor, my background had really been in African-American political history. My training was in constitutional and legal questions. And I was so taken aback that they would ask me to write this history of black women in Indiana. I do remember thinking when Shirley Hurd made the call that this is a taxpayer, and those of us who work at public institutions should be kind to taxpayers. So I will explain to her why I cannot write this book about black history of black women in Indiana. And it was because there were no sources. No one had ever written anything of that nature. There was nothing for me to base it on. And I told her that I could not write such a history. I was not trained or prepared to do so. And that, in fact, the only three black women I had ever studied in my training were Phyllis Wheatley, Sojourner Truth, and Harriet Tubman. And to the best of my knowledge, not one of them lived in Indiana. So she at that point said to me, well, let me get this straight. You are a black woman, aren't you? And I said, yes. And she said, you are a historian, aren't you? And I said, yes. She said, you mean you can't put those two things together and write us a history of black women in Indiana? And it was at that point that I said, well, Mrs. Hurd, historians can write histories of anybody and anything and any event. But a historian has to decide that those people, like the quote, are worthy of investigation. Apparently no one in Indiana has ever decided that black women in Indiana are worthy of this investigation. But she persisted. And so it was at that moment that I said, I'll take a look. And this was 1980. And for the next 26 years, I've been devoting my research, the bulk of my research and career, to investigating the history of black women in America and in the diaspora. And it started because I was challenged by a person who was a third grade teacher, head of the community organization, who recognized before I did that a significant component of the population was missing from the history books.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story, and I am sure that there would have been people other places, not just in Indiana, but other places, other black women who would have said likely the same thing. They would mm-hmm. said, "Well, wait a minute. We have our contribution, our role, what mm-hmm. we've done here has been left out of the books." I mean, you could argue even at that point that that overall in American history, the role, the contribution of African Americans was underreported, but even less so would be the contributions of black women. So it would seem like that here this would be an important challenge to the entire field of history,
exactly.
of American history, to
exactly.
say, There's something really important here that's been missed.
Well, the question with historians, first of all, the profession then willfully deny black women presence and importance in the making of America. But the way we frame our questions at that moment generally focused around political issues, economic issues, military history was very important, international diplomatic relations, you know, these were the kinds of things that were very important. And we had a great man approach, or a great white man approach, or a great black man approach to doing and studying history. And so if you frame your questions like that, then you don't look at the kinds of critical areas where black women would be making these contributions, building communities, building institutions, mobilizing their own national network of organizations, struggling to educate the children, to make life more livable and to ensure the survival in terms of health care provisions for people in the communities. So a historian would really have to ask a whole different set of questions about what makes a community viable, what are the forces and factors that enable survival in a hostile, segregated community. And once I started asking those kinds of questions, and the sources were there, and the women were there, and it was a glorious experience in discovery. It was as if a whole new universe opened up to me as a professional historian.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that rather than make them wait? Someone who is calling us on a cell phone. It's our line number one, so let's go right there. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I just recently reread Anne Moody's Coming of Age in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. I read it when it first came out in about 1968, and I've never heard of her again, and she's a wonderful writer and was very active, and I wondered if you knew whatever happened to her.
Her book was very important, and I've used it in courses over the years, but I do not know at this moment where she is or what happened to her. She sort of fell out of sight. The last I heard, and that was many, many years ago, was that she was living somewhere in New York. But I simply do not have any concrete, up-to-date information about Ann Moody.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
I was hoping you'd know.
No, I wish I did.
I've been wondering ever since I reread the book, like, what happened?
And that, and that's been almost close to 40 years ago. That she, you know, wrote that book about her experiences in segregated Mississippi and involvement in the civil rights movement. Very important book.
Yeah, and New Orleans also.
Yes, yes.
New Orleans as well. Maybe you can look into it.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Darlene Clark-Hine. She is director of the Center for African American History at Northwestern University, where she's professor of history. And she is here visiting the campus. Will be taking part in a symposium titled Black Women and Activism, sponsored by the African American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You were just talking a little earlier about the fact that once you really started looking for sources to do this kind of work, that they were there.
They were there.
Were they in unconventional places?
Or yes.
Did a lot of this turn out to be things like memoirs and journals and letters and things that women had written about their experiences that weren't in a sense kind of in, they weren't in, they wouldn't have been in archives in the places that you might normally go and look for that kind of information?
Well, what happened after I agreed to do this, project with the Black women in Indiana, it became apparent that we needed to collect the materials, the sources, from women who had them in their basements and attics and dresser drawers and closets and sometimes in garages that the archivists had not made any concerted effort to collect the material. And even if they had made concerted effort to collect all of these materials that Black women had, and I'll tell you in a moment what some of these materials were, Black women weren't ready to just hand over materials to the historical societies that had not included them for decades. So we had to develop the archives, and what we did discover were a lot of papers of organizations. There were records from all the churches that Black women had been active in creating and supporting and fundraising activities. There were records of community centers, of daycare centers, of healthcare centers that they had established. There were all kinds of organizational and institutional records, as well as personal documents that Black women had accumulated. And so the first project that I had to coordinate was called Black Women in the Middle West Project, and it was to develop archives, to make copies of some of these records, and to put them in the traditional places that people go to research when they're doing any kind of historical project. So the Indiana Historical Society, for example, has a lot of the material. In Chicago, the Carter G. Woodson Vivian Harsh Collection, the Chicago History Museum, which is the Chicago Historical Society. So the archivists in these two states in particular, Illinois and Indiana, joined in with the women, the community women, and this project to create the archives. And then other people in different states became inspired by the example and started almost a nationwide movement to collect the archives and records of Black women and to put them in traditional archives and historical societies.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. We have another caller here. This is someone in Champaign. It's line one.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for a wonderful program and guest. I was wondering if your speaker could share her thoughts specifically on how this recovery of public memory from below, let's say, relates to organizing, social justice organizing, and specifically women in the present. I am involved in a similar sort of project, and I'd like her thoughts on what are the connections and how a recovery of this past informs the present social justice movements. I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call.
I think, first of all, people with a sense of history and a sense of the past, with a full appreciation of their role in past social struggles, or the role of people who look like them, who were related to them, who shared the same kinds of backgrounds that they come from. I'm talking about working class women now, and you give them a sense of what has happened in the past and how people mobilize and struggle to change their circumstances, to undermine and overthrow legalized segregation and discrimination, exclusions from the larger civic life of any community. Then you are empowered to see the possibilities of mobilization in the present to transform lingering and continuing inequalities and oppressions. So the past becomes a foundation. As I tell my students, when you recover the past in the present, you're able to develop and articulate a more coherent strategy for continued activism to change the future, to make the future better. But if you don't know where you've been, how can you possibly develop a blueprint or an agenda for where you want to go and how to get there? So the past is very, very important in terms of consciousness, a sense of empowerment, a sense of what's possible, and building connections with others similarly engaged in social justice struggles.
All right, and let's talk with someone else. This is someone listening in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Would you be so kind as to give us a thumbnail history of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana, as we have a lot of Indiana listeners, and this would bear heavily on the history of Black women. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Is that something you can talk about?
Well, that would require more time than we have in this particular program. But I would direct a caller to one of the best books on the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana and in the country at large. And that's a book by Nancy McLean. Nancy McLean is a historian, chair of the history department at Northwestern University. And I think that if you picked up a copy of her study of the Ku Klux Klan, it will answer all of these questions. Mm-hmm. But Indiana was a stronghold for the KKK in the 1920s. And there are still, even in 2006, Klan sympathizers or sympathizers with the ideologies espoused by the Klan. The Klan was not just an anti-Black organization. It was anti-Catholic. It was anti-Semitic. It had very, very, it was anti-woman suffrage. It was a very fundamentalist kind of operation that did not like the other, and the other is in quotes. The lynching, anti-lynching campaign that the black women started beginning in the late 1890s and really mobilized and formalized into a crusade in the 1920s, 1930s. They were pushing for anti-lynching legislation throughout the first, 50 years of the 20th century. It was in to counter the violence of the Klan and the lynchings of their sons and their husbands and their brothers and their uncles, whatever. So the Klan was a white terrorist organization, and black women were the ones that spearheaded the movement to make lynching a federal crime, to try and get the Senate, of course, to act and to protect the civil rights of black people. Now, of course, in 2005, the United States Senate, to its credit, better late than never, did adopt an official resolution apologizing for its failure to enact anti-lynching legislation when the black women in the NAACP had asked them to.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, let me introduce. We're talking with Darlene Clark Hine. She is the director of the Center for African American History at Northwestern University, and she's also professor of history there. She is visiting the campus.
Professor of African American Studies.
Oh, I guess I thought you were actually both of those things.
Yes, I'm the Board of Trustees Professor of African American Studies and Professor of History.
And Professor of History. Okay, I don't want to leave anything out, anything that's really important. She is all that, and someone who has really been recognized for a long time as being a leading historian, not just of the African-American experience, but particularly of black women's history. And she's written many books on the subject. She's here to take part in the symposium, looking specifically at the role of black women in civil rights and in 20th century black history. And we're really pleased that she could be here and spend some time with us this morning. I do also maybe want to mention that in conjunction with this symposium, a film is going to be shown tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. It's the film Standing on My Sister's Shoulders. It is an award-winning documentary about the civil rights movement in Mississippi during the 50s and 60s that's told from the point of view of the women who were involved in it. And the film will be shown in room 228 of the Natural History Building. That's at 810 South Wright in Urbana. There will be discussion afterwards. And again, I'm sure that anybody who's interested in stopping by and seeing the film should feel welcome. Also here on the show, questions welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about the way that this is not exactly something new, but I think that it's something important. The way that the orientation of the field of history has changed, to the extent that there has been some movement away from the great man approach. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that there weren't significant individuals that you want to talk about, but more historians concentrating on the lives and actions of regular people.
Ordinary people.
Working people, men, women. Mm-hmm. And how it is that they, what their part was in the great course of American history.
Well, one of the things that happened since the 1960s was the rise of the new social history, and the premise was simply that we need to also be concerned with the history of the people who did not fall into the category of the great white male, but who nevertheless individually were representative of larger social groupings and forces. And so we wanted to write the history from the bottom up, so to speak. So that opened up questions about the labor movement, about immigrants and their experiences in coming to America. It also opened up the space for us to study new ethnic groupings and questions about racial formation and social justice. So judge from the history on, we've had fields in history concentrating on Asian Americans, you know, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Pacific Islanders, if you will, more courses on, and historians focused on the history of First Nation Americans or Native Americans, if you will, Hispanic, Latino history. So what we've done is to make history much more inclusive, to look at the working class as well as the middle class and the elites, to give more respect to the struggles of ordinary people doing, in many cases, extraordinary things to make our country great. Now, this has not been without controversy, because there are people who think that when we talk about women, or when we talk about blacks, or we talk about Hispanics, we are somehow diminishing American history, that we are perverting it, that we are substituting discussions of Harriet Tubman for Abraham Lincoln. Now, how could that be possible? Why do we need to know about Frederick Douglass when we can just talk about, Stephen Douglass? so there is a lot of opposition to this new social history. And my response to that is that we're not displacing anybody. What we're saying is, let's make this history more inclusive, more rich, more textured, more nuanced, more sophisticated. Let's make this history of America a history that represents all of the diverse strings and strands and peoples that made this country great, so that we can all have a stake in the American past and therefore look forward to a better future. So that's my response to that. I hate to sound like I'm on a soapbox, but I do believe that American history has been made better because we now pay attention to all of these different groups.
I had an opportunity to look at a textbook that you co-authored that I thought was a wonderful book, and I'm not exactly sure what level this was intended for, if this was a high school textbook or it was a middle school book. It was a large significant mm-hmm. book. And I guess one of the things that I thought about was that, at the time that I might have been in high school, that there was nothing like that. There was nothing like that. And that made me think about, what now, if you take a look at public school curricula at elementary, secondary levels, how much African-American history, if we just pick that, how much African-American history is being taught? I came across an article that in which you were quoted that had to do with the decision, I believe this was in Philadelphia, to actually make that a required part of the school curriculum. I'm not sure where else they've actually done anything like that. I'm interested in, to the extent to which this is now in a very formal and deliberate sort of way, a part of the history program that kids are going to get in school.
I'm impressed. You've done your research.
We try.
Actually, last year, the Philadelphia School Board mandated that every student graduating from high school in Philadelphia will have to take this course in African-American history. And although the parents had first approached, Philadelphia black parents had first approached the school board 37 years ago with a request to integrate black history into the high school curricula, they were rebuffed. But this time, the school board voted unanimously in favor of this mandate, and they were able to do that because members of the school board brought into the discussion copies of the textbook that Bill Hines, Stanley Harrell, and I had written called The African American Odyssey.
I think that's the one that I'm thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, The African American Odyssey. And the interesting thing about that was that that was a college textbook. Uh-huh. It's, we had, it's in the, going into its fourth edition, but it was never geared towards the high schools, but very, you know, intrepid, progressive high school teachers had been using this college textbook, and a number of them had been using it to prepare students to take advanced placement exams and what have you, but it was not directed towards the high school. So once the Philadelphia board decided to mandate this law, they came to us and asked if we could transform this college-level textbook into a high school-level textbook. And Prentice Hall agreed to do it. That's the publisher. And we worked on it, and we made it the most wonderful and beautiful, aesthetically pleasing, intellectually engaging high school textbook that it was possible to do, because we wanted only the best. And the Philadelphia board came in for a lot of criticism because people, again, were saying, well, why do we need a course in black history? Why not Polish American history or what have you? But Philadelphia held firm. And last September, they purchased 13,000 copies of that textbook. Well, school systems all over the country have been looking at the Philadelphia experiment. That was a big thing. Just last 2 weeks ago, I was in South Carolina, and South Carolina is now considering or making it required that black history is taught in all of the schools in the state of South Carolina. And so I was down there talking to the South Carolina Council of Black Studies because they were interested in the textbook and using it in the school system. So there are a lot of urban school systems that are looking at this very closely. A lot of teachers have already on their own selected the textbook as their main text. And one of the things that they all say, all the teachers I've spoken with, they say that they like the fact that this history of African Americans is really a history of America, that this is American history with an emphasis on the black perspective, but the Civil War still happens in the 1860s. You know, the American Revolution still happens when it happened. It's not as if we are distorting the history. We're simply giving it a deep appreciation of the African American experience within the American, the larger American story. So you get two histories now for the price of one. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that the teachers told me that they really like about this is that we start from Africa, the African background. We don't start with slavery. We focus on the civilizations that Africans had created before the slave trade and the kinds of social systems and values and technological developments and the economy that was prevalent. And then we talk about the slave experience, the process of enslavement. And finally, that there's a lot of information in there about women, black women, from the slave trade days all the way up to the present. And so they are very, very positive and encouraged with this book. And students seem to be responding to it because it's something new. It's different. And they're enjoying it. Those are the reports that I have heard. And finally, to respond to your larger question, I do want to say that there is more information about black history in traditional American history courses now at all levels than ever before. So my colleagues in the historical profession have been making significant changes in telling the story about African Americans from the colonial period to the present. And it would just be wrong to assume that things have not changed in 40 years.
Mm. I'm sure that this whole question of what kind of history do you teach, whose history do you teach, how do you teach it, will continue to be controversial, and there'll be arguments everywhere. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that if, for example, that you have entire states or cities that would say, we think it's very important for African-American history to be part of the curriculum, there will be other places where people will say, wait a minute, what about Chicano history? That mm-hmm. should be in the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Or other people would say, wait a minute, what about the history of Asian Americans and the role that they played in America? That should be in the curriculum. And some people might say, well, that's all to the good. Yeah, mm-hmm. sure, that all should be. But then I can see, you know, history teachers feeling, how do I do that? I mean, how do I really meet the challenge of teaching this much larger history? It was hard enough before.
Right.
Now you're opening up the frame so much wider.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bigger story. It's a better story. It's a more complete story. But it's also it makes it much harder to teach.
Becomes unwieldy.
Yes, exactly.
And the teachers become very frustrated. And it's a question of, well, how much do you include here, and what? And what do you emphasize? Well, if I'm teaching the colonial period in American history, it seems to me that I will include much more information about Native Americans than before, and that maybe I won't be biased in my discussion of Native Americans as these obstacles that had to be eliminated so that America could expand and flourish. But maybe I'll talk about the exchanges and the encounters and who some of what Native American culture was really like at that particular moment when these populations came into contact. Now, if I'm going to talk about the Civil War, instead of just talking about the North and the South and the military campaigns and Lincoln and his generals, maybe I'll spend a little bit more time talking about the 209,000 African-American men who fought in the Civil War and talk about their experiences as soldiers, trying to get equal pay for equal work, some of their involvement in key military campaigns. And then when I'm talking about the Depression, well, maybe I'll talk about the impact that the Depression had on the agricultural communities around the country that led to the displacement of African Americans and helped to launch the second great migration of, you know, millions of African Americans into northern cities that then transformed the northern cities like Chicago and Detroit and so on and so forth. So that I'm not, and also the Mexican Americans and our relations with Mexico. We talk about immigration, and it's a big issue right now. Well, Mexicans have been coming to America or coming into American cities and being involved in American agricultural productions for throughout the 20th century. Why not give a more nuanced understanding of our involvement in Mexican affairs from Pancho Villa all the way up to understand their experiences in America. So there are strategic moments where you enrich the history by just bringing in different groups of people. And when you talk about suffrage and the expansion of the franchise, you just can't talk about universal male suffrage. You have to talk about women's suffrage and the struggles that women waged to get the right to vote. So that's what I mean about complicating the history. At strategic moments, bring in the groups that help to move whose experiences and struggles helped to move this democratic process along. Because the most important thing about American history, I think, is this idea of democracy and this our belief in freedom and justice. Well, democracy didn't just happen in America. Different groups at strategic moments pushed the agenda, pushed it forward, and helped to expand democracy to make it real. So you want to, at least I do when I teach my courses, I want people to understand how American civilization developed over the course of these centuries and what the different groups contributed to that development. Does that seem to make it more wieldy?
Yeah, it does. I guess I still think that it's always been very challenging to teach history, but that it becomes more challenging because there seems to be more to think about and more to appreciate. Mm-hmm. I guess I think about, for example, just, you know, the opportunity I've had in doing the show to talk to people about subjects like this. And I reflect on the kind of history that I got when I was in school and how cursory it really was. But it's also there are so many individual subjects, so many periods of American history, so many things that you could spend a lifetime studying that thing, and there are historians that do that. So that really makes me wonder however do you get anything for most people, however you get anything much more than a cursory sort of treatment, and then from that point they're kind of on their own. There are some people that decide mm-hmm. that history is going to be the way they spend the rest of their life, and then there are other people who are going to say, well, I'm interested in this. I'm going to continue to try to learn. It seems that there is just so much to learn and so little time in which to do it, and that most Americans are pretty poorly schooled in their own history, and I would include myself.
But education is a lifelong pursuit. And it doesn't stop. And my whole mission is to encourage people to embrace the whole notion of self-education so that once you take these formal courses in grammar school, high school, college, what have you, there should be something that touches you enough that you want some topic, some aspect that you learn, that you want to pursue it for the rest of your life. Maybe it's biography. Maybe you feel that you learn more by reading biographies of different people, and that's something that you want to follow through with. But the bottom line is education never stops. And you may become fatigued or whatever, but you should always, always pursue knowledge. And history, the beautiful thing about history is that the past is endless. Of course you can't know it all. And the only thing new in the universe is the history you never knew. Mm-hmm. So that's the beauty of it. That's the challenge of it.
Yeah. Really. Well, that and finding out that maybe what you knew wasn't right or didn't quite do it, or maybe it was a little bit right. But, you know, I guess it gets me thinking about how sometimes upset people can be when they have learned some particular version of history, and then historians will come along and say, well, you know, we've thought about this, we've learned new things, there is new material out there, and we think actually that it was a little bit different than the way that we taught you 30 years ago. People don't like that.
but every historian worth his or her salt will tell you that our knowledge is contingent upon the discovery of new facts and what have you, so that we don't speak in absolutes. We have to leave our minds open for what a discovery of a new cache of sources might reveal about a particular event. But again, that's the dynamic dimension of this field. That's why I can be engaged in it for 30 years and still feel I'm learning all the time.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say the things you do, and I think it's an important thing for people to hear. I just think about the fact when people sort of get up on their high horse and say, "Oh, this revisionist history." And they don't appreciate the fact that history is revisionist. Of course, it is.
Yes,
you're always. It's not like once the book is written, you put it up on the shelf and that's that. No, history is not like that. Mm-hmm. But maybe that goes back to the idea that we'd like to have this notion that something doesn't change. Well,
right.
Well, forget that.
Well, that's why we have chronology.
The dates of the Civil War will not change.
The dates of the Civil War will not change. World War II will not change. It happened when it happened. The Great Depression occurred in the 1930s. Yeah. It will not change. That's chronology. But history is something else.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, we have a couple of callers. Maybe let's mention here, the Associated Press is reporting this morning that Republican officials say Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld is stepping down. We want to mention that because we won't have our regular newscast at the top of the hour. We will have a live coverage of a press conference by President Bush, no doubt talking about yesterday's election. So stay with us here on AM 580. We'll get that to you. We do have, I think, a couple of callers we'd like to try to include, I think we have someone here on line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
I was wondering if your materials have had any impact overseas. People overseas have an inordinate curiosity about the U.S. and how it works and what it is, and often it's not easy to find out what the black-white situation is. I've really been impressed by a couple of books written by a guy named Ball on slavery, and it helped me as someone from a different country to understand what's going on. I think it would be very helpful to find some of these materials elsewhere around the world.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I haven't made any particular efforts to send the textbook over or to market the textbook overseas, but I'm more familiar with how my work in black women's history and black women's studies has been received overseas than this academic textbook that we were talking about earlier. As a matter of fact, a few years back I went to New Zealand to talk to Maori women in New Zealand because they were interested in how African-American women had written the history of African-Americans into the history of the nation state, and they wanted to see if they could write Maori women's experiences into the history of New Zealand. And so that's just one example of how the work that I've been doing in black women's history has been playing overseas. But thank you for your question.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. We're just about the point here. We're going to have to stop. And my apologies. I have one more caller I won't be able to take. But we've got to end just a little bit early because we have the noontime press conference. I want to mention one more time that our guest here, Darlene Clark Hine, is here to take part in a conference symposium looking at the role of black women in civil rights. It's sponsored by the African American Studies and Research Program. She will be giving a talk tonight. This is the Ida B. Wells Barnett Lecture. Talking on the topic From Respectability to Respect, Black Women's Civic Culture and Consciousness in Jim Crow America. I do also want to correct something. I think I gave incorrect information before. This was about the film showing. Again, this was a documentary, an award-winning documentary about the civil rights movement in Mississippi in the 50s and 60s and the role of women standing on my sister's shoulders. That will be 7 o'clock tomorrow night. It is at the Natural History Building in room 228, but I gave the wrong street address. So in case you go looking for it, it's at 1301 West Green Street on the campus. Our guest, Darlene Clark Hine, is professor of African American Studies and professor of history and director of the Center for African American History at Northwestern University. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.